Hi everyone. This November marks the one-year anniversary of Chattanooga Civics. This show has been so rewarding to create. I've been able to meet some amazing people throughout this city and have some really interesting conversations. And of course, I'm always thrilled when listeners reach out and provide feedback. I'm really just glad people are finding this information helpful. This next year, I would like to take this show to the next level. As part of the birthday celebrations, I'm asking every listener to share their favorite episode with their friends, whether it be on social media, by email, or simply by word of mouth. If you do use social media, be sure to tag the show. And as always, if you would like to leave a tip, or if you own a local business and would like to sponsor an episode, you can head to ChattanoogaCivics.com. As always, thanks for listening. Now on to the show. This is Chattanooga Civics. I'm Nathan Bird. One of the most important aspects of city government is zoning. Zoning regulations impact housing prices, transportation, property taxes, and more. In this episode, we'll learn more about the Regional Planning Agency, a key player in the city's zoning process.
I'm Karen Hunt, and I'm the director of the Community Planning and Design Division of the Regional Planning Agency.
Great. So could you give me a little bit of background on the Regional Planning Agency, just very broad overview of what this organization is, how it's organized, what it does?
Sure. So we call it the RPA for short. Mm-hmm. We are a city-county agency, so we work for both the City of Chattanooga and all of Hamilton County, including some of the other small towns within Hamilton County. The planning agency is established basically by state law. So we work on zoning for all of those areas. We also have a division that works on transportation planning. Mm-hmm. A lot of the federal funding for roads and things gets funneled through our organization. The money doesn't literally get funneled through, but the decisions get funneled through us. So we host that, and then my division focuses on area plans. We've divided Hamilton County into 12 geographic areas, mm-hmm. and so we're systematically developing an area plan for new growth and development for each one of those.
Okay.
And then we also have a research and development, research and analysis division that works on a lot of crunching a lot of census numbers and mm-hmm. traffic modeling, that sort of thing.
Okay. So you mentioned the area plans, and I want to spend most of the interview talking about those. But before we get into that, I do want to clarify a couple questions. So in my interview last week, I interviewed Councilman Ledford, and he walked through the process of how a rezoning case is heard. And basically going from a rezoning application that goes through a staff review at the RPA, then it goes to Planning Commission, and then it goes to City Council or County Commission. And so I want to back up a little bit and focus on that kind of RPA staff review level and just ask, what are the criteria that y'all use to analyze a rezoning case? What makes you say a recommend to approve, recommend to deny, or attach particular conditions? What is all that based off of, and where does that information come from?
Okay. Yeah, each month the staff has a meeting, and we review all of the rezoning requests we've received mm-hmm. during that month. We either say we recommend to approve it, we recommend deny it. Sometimes it's an approval with specific conditions mm-hmm. added, those sorts of things. So the things we look at, we often start with the area plan. Or the land use plan. Mm-hmm. We don't have area plans for all 12 of those geographic areas right. I just mentioned yet. So some of these are like old neighborhood mm-hmm. plans that have been on the books for years, some of which are very outdated, which mm-hmm. is one reason we're switching to this 12 areas.
Right.
But we always look at the adopted plan for the area, if there is one.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the recommendations that were made in that plan. We look at the land use map in the plan, because it tells us if an area should be commercial in the future, or if it's supposed to say single family residential, or if there's an opportunity for multifamily residential, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So that's a big part of it. And all of those plans receive a lot of public input. So it's a good place to start. It's something that the community in that area has bought into.
Right.
The city council has adopted it. Our mm-hmm. staff has worked on it. So that's a really good starting place. Some of the other things we look at transportation issues. We also have a long-range transportation plan.
Mm-hmm.
That looks at not just Hamilton County, but parts of North Georgia as well. But for each zoning case, we also look at that plan to see what's recommended. Is it on a corridor that's supposed to be widened in the next mm-hmm. couple of years? Is it on an area that has a high-frequency transit route? If that's the case, you know, maybe we want to bump up the density really high to help mm-hmm. support that transit. In an area maybe that's designated as a new bike corridor. Maybe we need to think about that. So we look at those issues. Sometimes the transportation plan will then influence some of the conditions, or if the area plan has pointed out something that's specific about that particular location that might generate a condition. And then we also just look at previous zoning history, what's happened in the area over the years, what kind of zoning is around mm-hmm. it. You know, for instance, if someone's requesting to rezone from a residential property to a commercial property because they want to put a store of some kind there,
mm-hmm.
we'll look and see, A, if there's any commercial zoning around it already, or if maybe we've had requests in the past and maybe they were approved, maybe some got turned down, and we'll go back and see why were they turned down, kind of
right.
what's the history of requests in that area. So those are probably the three primary things,
mm-hmm.
is the adoptive plan for the area, the transportation plan, and then the zoning that's around it, or the zoning
right.
history.
So if the land use plan for the area is kind of outdated, you said some of them are much older, does that factor into the recommendations that are at all, or are you all bound to that land use plan to make recommendations based on that plan, even though it is 20, 30 years old?
Yeah, I don't think we have any 30 years old, but we probably do have some that are about almost 20 years old. We do look at how long ago it was adopted, and for the ones that are getting pretty old, we'll then start looking at, okay, what has changed in the area since then?
Right.
Does it still look pretty much the way it did when the plan was adopted 10, 15 years ago, or have we seen a lot of changes in that area?
Mm-hmm.
So if we haven't seen any change, we might say, well, okay, the plan is still pretty relevant. Let's go with that. On the other hand, if, you know, you say you've already seen a lot of new commercial development in an area, even the plan maybe say otherwise, we say, well, okay, things have really changed, so maybe we need to look more at what exists today rather than what the plan says.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to move on and talk more about these plans, and I want to start, you've talked about the area plans a little bit, but I want to talk about the comprehensive plan.
Mm-hmm.
I was browsing around the website and saw this document that was adopted in 2016, I believe,
right.
and I was just wondering, what is kind of the scope of that comprehensive plan? How is it used? What is the lifespan of that comprehensive plan before you think it might need to be updated or even completely replaced? So could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. The comprehensive plan covers all of Hamilton County. So that's kind of the big umbrella plan, if you
mm-hmm.
will. And then within that, we have these 12 area plans
mm-hmm.
that we're developing. And so the comprehensive plan, just because it is a much larger area, tends to be more general,
mm-hmm.
whereas the area plans get a little more specific. The comprehensive plan kind of looks at big picture issues like transportation systems across the whole county, natural systems, environmental issues, you know, flooding or steep slopes or whatever, those kinds of things. So it's much broader
mm-hmm.
Some of the other things we looked at in this last comprehensive plan was housing, just an overall need for more affordable housing throughout the county, those sorts of things. So it really doesn't get into a lot of specifics,
right?
Whereas the area plans will tend to get a little more location specifics,
right?
Where it's a comprehensive plan, really it's issues that would typically cover all of Hamilton County. Mm-hmm.
And so what was the kind of design life of that plan, or is there one, or is it just going to kind of stay in place until there's a general consensus that it needs to be updated?
Yeah, and probably ideally we'd love to update it every 10 to 15 years,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 20. We typically, for a comprehensive plan at that large a scale, most communities will look at about a 15 to 20 year horizon.
Mm-hmm. And then what was the process for putting that plan together? And in terms of, you know, obviously I'm sure there's a lot of staff effort that went into it, but in terms of coordination between different city departments, public input, what was that process like?
Yeah, we always start with a lot of public input. We have community meetings for the comprehensive plan since it's countywide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little difficult to do that, but we do try to have different public meetings throughout different parts of the county. I know for that plan, I wasn't real directly involved in that particular planning effort, but they had a lot of what we call pop-up planner events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you go out to Hamilton Place Mall and have a little booth or table out there, or some other community event that draws a lot of people. We like to try and piggyback on things where we already have a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
If you just say, hey, we're coming to your part of the county to talk about the comprehensive plan, people think, oh, thrill, you know, what in the world is that? So we try to piggyback off of other events. We all the time do surveys. These days, a lot of it is online,
mm-hmm.
surveys, obviously. And in fact, a lot of our public meetings throughout the pandemic, we've had to switch to online meetings.
Right.
Which we were actually a little worried about that. We thought maybe we won't get as much public participation doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we found it's still been, I think we've had almost as much and in some cases more
mm-hmm.
participation. I think people just find that's a really convenient
mm-hmm.
way to give input. So public participation is a big part of that. We also analyze a lot of just existing conditions. You know, what are the traffic counts on all the major roads in the county? You know, where are the transit lines? Where are the bike facilities?
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of things. We'll look at, again, environmental related issues. You know, where are the floodplains throughout the county? We'll look at a lot of census numbers. Both just change in overall population as well as housing needs
mm-hmm.
across the county, income levels across maybe different zip codes. So we do a lot of analysis work on all of those types of things. And we typically then put all that together, come up with some initial recommendations or some initial goals perhaps, and then put those out to the community and say, okay, here's what we've gleaned from you so far.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about this? And get their reaction to that. And then flesh those out a little more. And then it's kind of an iterative process. We'll do that a couple times. And then eventually go back with a finalized plan and say, okay, we'll put it online, ask people to give comments again.
Mm-hmm.
And get their input, and then we may tweak it a little bit before it goes to the planning and city council for adoption.
Yeah, so what does that entail? I mean, does it actually, when it's adopted by the city council or the county commission, what actual effect does that have? I mean, do these areas get rezoned automatically per that plan, or what is the actual effect?
They do not automatically get rezoned. Sometimes we wish they would, but they don't. The plans are a guiding policy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the force of law behind them,
mm-hmm.
but they are a guiding policy. So probably the way they get used most often is to guide zoning decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So when the staff, as I mentioned before, is looking at a rezoning request, we look at those plans. The Planning Commission looks at the plans. City Council
or the county commission, if it's out in the unincorporated part of the county, mm-hmm. they all look at those plans. And those will help guide all of our decisions on a zoning case. So that's probably the way it's used the most. Another way they're used, though, is to inform capital budgeting.
Mm-hmm.
So if the city or the county are looking at road improvements, new sidewalks, bike lanes, any of those sorts of things, for instance, they may look to the plans to see where those types of things are called for and base it on that. Sometimes if a plan identifies a need for some changes in zoning, which they often do because our zoning is really old,
mm-hmm.
We'll call for a zoning study and say, you know, we recommend that this neighborhood or this section of the county undergo a zoning study to mm-hmm. bring it more up to date with the plan. But it doesn't, the plans never actually immediately change the zoning on any particular right. piece of property.
Right. So as part of this comprehensive plan that we've just talked about, like you said, it's been split up into 12 areas.
Mm-hmm.
And just based on the website, my understanding is that we have two of these areas completed and one is currently underway. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Could you tell me about those that have been completed?
Sure. The first one is out in the Ootowah-Apison mm-hmm. Summit area. We call it Area 12. We numbered all of them,
mm-hmm.
But the numbers are not chronological. We just
right.
say, well, okay, we have 12, and we actually started with number 12. So that's Area 12. Is out in the far southeast corner mm-hmm. of the county. Collegedale is also in that area. Now, they're a separate municipality, and mm-hmm. they already had their own adopted plan. So we just coordinated with them and kind of right. incorporated what they already had. That one was really interesting. It was our first one, and they had a lot of, as you can imagine, issues with traffic through the area mm-hmm. and a lot of new growth that they were concerned about. A lot of folks moved out to that area because it was very rural at the mm-hmm. time, and that's why they wanted to be there, and now right. they're seeing a lot of new development coming in. So there was a lot of concern about that. The second area plan was what we call Area 3. But it's the historic River to Ridge area. Mm-hmm. So basically everything between the downtown and Missionary Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of your older neighborhoods. It's interesting because we had like kind of completely different issues in many ways in
right.
that area, where out in the Ootowah-Apison area you had, you know, lots of concern about traffic congestion. We had zero concern about that in the historic River to Ridge area.
Right.
And one of the reasons is, if you look at a map, you'll see that area, the historic River to Ridge area, has a real good network of streets,
mm-hmm.
very connected streets, and so that traffic gets dispersed throughout
right.
all those streets. On the other hand, the further you get away from the downtown, you get a less connected street
mm-hmm.
network, and we tend to have, you know, a lot of subdivisions that all dump onto one major corridor,
right.
like East Brainerd Road,
yeah.
so that's where all the traffic goes. So it makes sense that the folks way out in East Brainerd had a lot of traffic concerns. The folks in Highland Park, Ridgefield,
mm-hmm.
those areas had none.
Right.
So it's pretty interesting. But they had other issues like affordable housing
mm-hmm.
and jobs and that sort of thing.
And how do those plans, how do they react to issues like that? You know, things like affordable housing, gentrification. What are kind of the tools in the toolbox to react to those issues versus the tools that you might have to react to transportation issues? You know, like you said, in the Area 12, everybody's funneled onto the same two or three roads, like East Brainerd Road or Ootowah-Ringgold Road and all those. So what are kind of the tools in the toolbox to react to these different issues?
For affordable housing, one of the tools we use is zoning. In past plans, some of the old land use plans that are now getting very old, we really didn't recommend a lot of new zoning for multifamily housing.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of, if some apartments were already there, well, that was the zone they got. But there really wasn't a lot of opportunity for new mm-hmm. zoning, for new multifamily housing. And I think that's something that's changed a lot with these 12 area plans we're doing now. We've tried to identify places where that makes sense. And a lot of people are just adverse to multifamily housing. They don't want a big apartment complex really close to their neighborhood, mm-hmm. and we get that. But instead, we're taking what we call a centers and corridors approach. So let's identify the commercial centers in each of these areas. And some of them are big, some are small. You know, Hamilton Place is really big, but then you get some just little tiny kind of neighborhood commercial centers. But around each of those, let's try to cluster some higher density housing. You know, maybe it's a big apartment complex around Hamilton Place, but a little mm-hmm. neighborhood node. Maybe it's just some townhomes or a quadruplex or something. Mm-hmm. So we've used that as a tool to try and encourage more diversity in housing types, which tends to get you, because you may have smaller units and a greater diversity, it'll tend to, hopefully some of those will be more affordable. Mm-hmm. For transportation issues, again, we work very closely with our staff here that are involved in the long-range transportation plan. Mm-hmm. And so we try to coordinate with them, make sure that some of the recommendations and the plans make their way eventually into the long-range transportation plan and coordinate on that. Usually with transportation, it's a matter of funding. So you've got, that's one of the ways we get funding, is mm-hmm. you've got to get it in that long-range, at least federal funding, get it in that long-range transportation plan and then kind of on the short list.
Right. I guess another question, did the area plans have any bearing on, you know, kind of subdivision regulations? One thing that comes to mind, especially when we're talking about transportation, is generally if a developer buys a piece of land, they build it all out with single family homes, and there's a couple cul-de-sacs and maybe a loop road, and usually there's only one or two entrances. Mm-hmm. Do these area plans have any impact on being able to connect those down the road? I mean, we talked about how the Area 3 River to Ridge, mm-hmm. you look at it and it's a grid.
Right.
And so if one road is backed up, you can kind of go down another street and it exactly. kind of works itself out mm-hmm. at the end of the day. Whereas if everybody's being funneled onto the same three streets, there's not a lot of play in the system. Mm-hmm. Do the area plans have any impact on that, or is that kind of outside their scope?
Sometimes we try to influence that. Street connectivity is a really touchy issue. From a traffic management, you know, solving traffic congestion standpoint, it's a great tool if you provide more connections. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you already live in a neighborhood and you're on a cul-de-sac, you probably don't want to connect to the mm-hmm. cul-de-sac across, or to the subdivision next to you. And a lot of people are fearful that they'll get a lot of cross traffic through the neighborhood. There's always a fear of you know, crime and that sort of thing. So we get a lot of resistance and a lot of pushback, I think, from the existing neighborhoods when we recommend those types of things. So we have to try to look for areas that are, I don't know, kind of no-brainers. It's like, mm-hmm. well, okay, this one's not going to cause, you know, a lot of impacts in the neighborhood, but it really could help with traffic congestion. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of few and far between, mm-hmm. honestly. I wish we could do more of that, but it's just a tough situation because you get a lot of opinions on both sides of the
right.
issue.
Right. And then how granular do these plans get? I mean, are you looking at each individual lot as they exist now, or is it more kind of bubbles that encompass maybe a block or mm-hmm. half of a block?
Kind of somewhere in between, I guess. Mm-hmm. We do produce a map for each area plan, what we call a place type map. Mm-hmm. And so every single property is coded with a place type. Mm-hmm. And that's probably about as granular as it gets from that standpoint. We do, though, like I said, we identify potential commercial centers, maybe some that already exist, and then potentially some new ones. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in those cases, it can get a little granular. For instance, out in Area 12, we identified a couple future commercial centers where nothing's there right now, mm-hmm. or at least no commercial development is there right now. And we produced some drawings, just kind of a vision concept of how it could build out mm-hmm. in the future. So it's not meant to say it has to happen exactly this way.
Right.
But, you know, here's an idea. If you do want this to be a commercial center in the future, this is how it might want to build out.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to things like that, do y'all, you know, we've talked about the public input process a little bit and how that works. How is that public input filtered, I guess? What other resources are you using to kind of filter that to get a desired outcome? And, you know, do you ever use any kind of outside consultants or outside, you know, be it academic or popular material to kind of filter these decisions? Or even, you know, technically it would be an outside consultant, but somebody here in town like Chattanooga Design Studio or, sure. or things like that.
Yeah, we do. Public input is a big part of it, but it's only one part.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think for any of the plans we've actually hired a consultant. I don't think we have, but for instance, the Chattanooga Design Studio produced a plan for the West Side.
Mm-hmm.
The planning agency did not do that.
Mm-hmm.
The design studio did, but it was adopted, I believe, by the city council. So occasionally we'll have someone like them will do a plan.
Mm-hmm.
We do consult, you know, with other agencies. Certainly we get input from people like the design studio, from Chattanooga Neighborhood Enterprise, not-for-profits perhaps in an area, certainly transportation folks, public works, other city departments mm-hmm. have a lot of input into it. Parks department has a lot of input into the plan. So we do take all that, as well as I mentioned just some of the analysis that we do in-house. Just looking at, you know, some of the changes in population, changes in zoning. And then we kind of take all that and pull it all together and put our city planner hats on and trying to pull it all together
mm-hmm.
To come up with a recommendation. I think that's kind of I like to tell people that's kind of what planners do. We're generalists and,
right.
and we know a little bit about a whole lot of different things
right.
and we try to pull it all together.
And is there much consideration or coordination with other infrastructure groups like Moccasin Bend in terms of getting, you know, sewer capacities, or is it kind of an assumption that those two things will have to grow together? As it gets more dense, Moccasin Bend will have to do some reaction. Who kind of leads on questions like that, or is it more collaborative?
But we try, yeah, we definitely try to coordinate with folks like that. For instance, in the Area 12 out in Apison, East Brainerd area,
mm-hmm.
we had quite a few conversations with them. There was a sewer moratorium
mm-hmm.
going on in part of that area at the time. So, yeah, we had several meetings with them and said, okay, what is the issue? How are you planning to address it? How long is it going to take? And based some of the plan recommendations around what we found out there. So sometimes we talk to the Department of Education,
mm-hmm.
see if they have any plans for new schools in the area. Or how far out that might be,
mm-hmm.
Which schools are already getting really filled up.
Right.
Again, we talk a lot to the transportation folks, public works department, parks department. We talk with, for instance, Trust for Public Land,
mm-hmm.
see what greenways they might have planned for an area and try to coordinate with them. So, yeah, we talk to a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this might be a hard question to answer in a general sense, but for a particular point of interest, like a school or a greenway, something you know might draw a lot of attention, how is that acted upon in the plan? Does that end up, you know, if it's a school, does it end up being higher density near the school, lower density because you're worried about overcrowding? How,
mm-hmm.
you know, do you want more people to be able to walk to the school, or do you want to make sure the school doesn't get overcrowded? Same thing with the trails and greenways. You know, do you want higher density along the greenway, or do you want to keep it more natural? And does it just vary? I mean,
yeah, and that's a good question. Typically with a school, as with commercial centers, we try to get a little higher density around it. So
mm-hmm.
Some kids could maybe actually walk to school.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a strange concept these days. They all tend to get dropped off by their parents. But we'd like to encourage more of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we do try and cluster a little bit of at least moderate density housing around a school. Obviously, you don't want to get too much, right, mm-hmm. And overcrowd the school. But again, we talk to the schools about, you know, what's the capacity
right.
at this school? How many more children could they take? Well, then how many households does that equate to? And, mm-hmm. and look at all those types of numbers. Greenways, not so much with Greenways. Really, with those, we just look more at potential connections.
Right.
What are people trying to get to?
Mm-hmm.
Are they trying to connect their neighborhood to a park or from the neighborhood to a school or to where are they maybe trying to ride their bike a little further to where they work on a greenway?
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of things. And then we'll sometimes, you know, maybe a greenway is already planned in an area and we'll just put it in our area plan
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, you know, Trust for Public Land is already working on this. Here's
right.
where it's going
it
to go.
Is, yeah.
Sometimes there is no greenway planned, and maybe we get a lot of input from the community saying they want one.
Mm-hmm.
The East Brainerd area plan that we're working on right now, that's happening. We've had
right.
a lot of interest from folks for a greenway that would connect, like, from Audubon Acres to Heritage Park up to Batter's Place, which all, incidentally, happened to be on a creek.
Right.
So it would be, you know, logical that to connect all that
mm-hmm.
with a greenway, but there's nothing planned really for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no funding allocated toward that, but it's probably a recommendation that will be in that plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully someone like the Trust for Public Land will pick that up in the future, or maybe some neighborhood groups or, you know, other organizations and,
right.
and implement part of it.
Right. And so we've talked about the River Ridge Plan, Area 3, the White Oak Plan, number 12, and then, as you just mentioned, the East Brainerd Plan, which is number 11, and you said that's underway.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of walk us through the process of that public input. Like, how does this process begin, and at what points can people get involved?
Well, all that's been a little different in the past
yeah.
year and a half, thanks to COVID. Typically, we start out each area plan with, well, we'll do some background research
mm-hmm.
and kind of look at all the existing conditions, do a little analysis, and then we'll have a public kickoff meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be a series of meetings, you know, throughout the area. Invite people to come. We'll show them, you know, what we found. You know, here's your population today. Here's how much it's growing. You know, here's some things that were changes we're seeing coming in the area based on new zoning, that sort of thing. And then we always ask them for input, whether it's in the form of a survey or, you know, just a discussion around tables and brainstorming.
Mm-hmm.
We do things, do different ways. Then we'll go back, take that information, usually come up with a list of principles and goals that seem to be coming out of that community.
Mm-hmm.
Then typically there's a second round of public input where we'll drill down a little deeper. For instance, you know, people may say, well, we want more affordable housing in our area. Well, okay, where do you want to put that housing? And again, we'll divide people up into groups and have big maps on the table and actually draw areas where you'd like to see something happen. And then we start developing some more specific recommendations based on that. And then we'll go back to the community again, usually, and kind of make sure we're on the right path, that
mm-hmm.
we haven't veered
mm-hmm.
too far off of what they've been saying. And then eventually at the end, when we have a draft plan ready, we'll put that out to the public on our website and let people know about it and ask them to give us some input. And then once it goes to the Planning Commission and City Council for adoption, those are public meetings, so people can
right.
get involved and come to those meetings and speak up, and they often do. But we try to use as many ways as we can to reach out to people. Again, when we're able to, we have in-person public meetings.
Mm-hmm.
The past year and a half, we've done a lot of online meetings using Zoom. We've done a lot of online surveys with this plan because we couldn't have a lot of public meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, again, like I was talking earlier, we'll go out to an event that they already have scheduled
right.
in the area and get feedback from them. So we also try to always maintain a really good email list. We find that's really the best way so far to
mm-hmm.
communicate with people. Every time we have a meeting, we'll ask them to give us their email address, and we've managed to build up, you know, several hundred names.
Mm-hmm.
for each area on these email lists, and then we'll send them updates pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
send them to our website to see something new. So that seems to be working pretty well, even in these COVID days when we can't actually meet with them in person.
Right. You mentioned kind of principles and goals coming out of this process, out of the public input process. I guess a couple questions in that direction. First, are there any principles and goals that are kind of baked into the process, either written into, you know, your guiding documents at the RPA or elsewhere, that are kind of considered regardless of what the public input is in terms of, you know, things that you were obligated to consider? And what might those be if there are?
Yeah, that's a great question. We typically start with the goals from the countywide comprehensive plan.
Mm-hmm.
And there are six, and I'm not going to be able to remember all of them, but it's things like connected communities.
Mm-hmm.
It is one. So we want, you know, a transportation system, whether it's cars or buses or bicycles or sidewalks that work for everyone mm-hmm. in the community. Complete communities is another one of the goals in the comprehensive plan, which is about kind of having a mix of different uses in a neighborhood. So, you know, you can easily get to a grocery store or to your children's school or whatever within a reasonable amount of time using, you know, whatever transportation mode you want,
mm-hmm.
those sorts of things. So, yeah, there are some kind of overarching large goals that we always try to carry through with each of the plans,
mm-hmm.
but then we just try to drill down and make them a little more specific to that specific location.
Right.
For instance, needing more affordable housing is mm-hmm. pretty much throughout the whole county. But again, we'll try to identify, well, what's the specific need in this area?
Mm-hmm.
What's their population like? Do they have, you know, a lot of single parents or a lot of people, young professionals moving into the area? What sort of housing might be best? And then we'll start to look for, say, locations where you could accommodate that in the future.
Right, right. Do you ever run into a situation where you're, you know, early on in the process, you're seeing a lot of desire for, I guess, let's use affordable housing as an example, and then later on in the process, after you've kind of put pen to paper and given kind of a rough overview, okay, we think there might be some opportunities for affordable housing in this area,
mm-hmm.
and then once people kind of see what the impact is, there may be backlash, you know, because affordable housing by definition tends to be more dense, tends to be more multifamily, and sometimes there's a lot of pushback from single family homeowners worried about property values. Do you see that kind of whiplash ever, and how do you address that? And more broadly, how do you address instances where some of these principles are butting up against each other?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, we do. That often happens. We try to minimize it as much as we can mm-hmm. by getting as many people involved and as much public input as we can up front, mm-hmm. but you can never reach everyone. So, yeah, I think we find a lot of times it's people that have not been involved in the process that come in at the end. They finally hear about it or they see it on the website or something mm-hmm. and say, whoa, you know, no, I don't like what that's showing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the more people we can involve up front, the less of a problem that becomes. We do, though, sometimes still have to go back and rethink some recommendations, especially if we're hearing from a lot of people saying, you know, that's not quite what we were thinking, or mm-hmm. we didn't understand that's what you were saying when we were talking about this. And we'll you know, rework the recommendation some. Sometimes I think if we can just sit down, especially if it's an individual property owner, just sit down and kind of walk them through it and say, you know, here's why we're proposing this. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we're able to work through that. That happened in the historic River to Ridge area because, again, there was a big need for affordable housing. We were proposing to kind of cluster some of the higher density housing around commercial centers and along commercial corridors. Because people had told us early on, said we don't want a bunch of high-density housing right in the middle of our single-family neighborhood.
Right.
We don't even necessarily want it right next to our single-family neighborhood.
Right.
I said, well, but you want affordable housing, so we've got to put it somewhere. So help us think about where it can go. And as we kind of talk people through that, they realized, okay, well, if we've got these commercial corridors, many of which have empty stores on them now, a lot of vacant property, you could put an apartment building there. And that way it supports the transit that's already on that corridor, and it supports some of the businesses along that corridor, but it's not right in the middle of my neighborhood. So we had a lot of conversations about that, particularly with the Area 3 plan. And pretty much unanimously, I think we were able to work through some of the objections once we kind of talked to people about why. And, you know, we're staying out of your neighborhood, but, you know, let's put it here on these corridors or in these commercial centers instead. And I think everybody, you know, once they kind of thought it through and realized that was the approach, bought into that idea.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's worked pretty well.
Right. And then for this public input process, to be involved in that, do you need to be a resident of the area, or are opinions of people inside and outside the area weighted differently? How does that work?
I would say 95% or more is people that live or work or own a business within the area. Occasionally we'll have some folks, for instance, South Chickamauga Creek runs through Area 11, East Brainerd area, where we're working now. So we may have, you know, some South Chickamauga Creek Alliance advocates that come to some of the meetings, and we certainly encourage that. But typically they're related to all the public input. It's a pretty small percentage.
Right.
So we really don't have to worry too much about how
really
it's
an issue.
Yeah.
Right. Are there ever any more kind of abstract goals, either through the comprehensive plan or through the public input process, that you have to work through? Things like, you know, climate change, racial justice, things like that. And how are those implemented in the area plans?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we tell people, you know, you can suggest anything, but the plans we work on tend to be about physical development. So it's things like housing and transportation and greenways and, you know, other things like that. So typically if people are sharing ideas with us about maybe some kind of social issue, education needs or something, we'll explain that that's really not our purview as the planning agency. We'll certainly take your ideas, but then we'll share them maybe with the Department of Education or whoever needs to hear it. So sometimes we'll get ideas that it's not, I guess it's just that they're not really things that we deal with as a planning agency.
Right.
Occasionally, though, we do get ideas for things that we've never thought of. What came up in one of our plans, actually I think it was a downtown plan years ago before we started this 12 geographic areas. We had a whole coalition of people in the downtown that came out and wanted bocce ball courts. And we're like, what is it with bocce ball courts? I mean, and they had a huge contingent that showed up, you know, at a couple of our meetings. And just from, you know, the number of survey responses, bocce ball courts made it onto, like, you know, the top 15 suggestions for the area. So yeah, every once in a while we get things kind of out of left field like that we're not expecting.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess the reason I asked, something I would never would have thought about something like that, you know, in terms of like climate change and racial issues. I think, you know, historically of things like redlining is very much a land use issue, a zoning issue in a lot of ways. And then, you know, climate change, housing density, transportation types play into that pretty directly.
Right.
Yeah, that's, I never would have thought bocce ball would make it on that list. That's interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, in the physical planning that we do relates indirectly to almost all of those things. Obviously, you know, the way you build out your community and how much paving you have in an area can impact the urban heat buildup and stormwater runoff and water quality and all of those things. You know, how safe a neighborhood is, where the school is located at home. So, I mean, all that can impact education levels and that sort of thing. But again, it's not our direct purview, but they're certainly all related. I mean, everything's interconnected.
Right. So what is the timeline for the East Brainerd plan that is underway right now? Where are you in the process, and when do you think a final plan might be going before City Council?
We hope to have a draft plan ready by the end of this calendar year.
Okay.
So the end of December, to start taking it out to some of our stakeholder groups, maybe some of the different city departments, make sure we haven't said something that they just can't go along with in the plan. Probably talk to a couple of the active neighborhood associations, city councilman that represents the area, those sorts of things. And then probably in January, hopefully we'll be able to post, January, February, be able to post that on our website, a draft plan, and invite public comments back on that. So once we get into that phase where there's a draft plan out there, it's hard for us to judge how long it's going to take. If people, everybody loves it and said, yeah, let's just adopt it and go, you know, you could wrap it up in a couple months. But it usually takes longer. Usually some issue crops up that maybe we hadn't quite fleshed out enough, or that we hadn't thought about, that might take another meeting or public meeting or two.
Right.
So it could dry out a little bit further. But hopefully, again, we'll have a draft ready toward the end of this year and get it out there for people to look at.
Right. And then what's the timeline for the other nine areas? Do you all have one picked out that's next, or how long do you think it'll take to complete all 12?
We have, the next one is what we call Area 10. It's the Hixson area. And kind of, I guess it's Red Bank, Hixson, kind of all up that way. Beyond that, I'm not sure which one will come up after that. We were hoping to be working on two simultaneously each year, so you kind of have them staggered about 6 months apart or so. Unfortunately, we've had a lot of turnover in staffing, and we're down to like half of our staff right now working on this, so it's taking longer than we would like.
Right.
But we were hoping to crank out at least two a year. Right now, it's kind of more like one a year.
Right.
Hopefully, we can get staff back up and
keep
everybody here and get it going a little faster.
On that note, are there any job openings that you want to plug on the podcast?
Yes, oh my goodness, yes. In fact,
might as well let everybody know.
We had a job opening out there. I think it closed today on the city's website for a senior planner on our staff here in community planning and design. But we actually have two vacancies. So we'd actually like to hire two people. We might hire one to start with and then advertise again for the second one. We might be able to hire two straight off if we get enough good applicants, but yeah, definitely. I mean, we're always looking for good people.
Right. So hopefully, you know, if anybody's listening to this podcast, they're interested in this topic, if they've made it 45 minutes in.
Yeah.
So I think that's all I have. Is there anything you want to talk about? Anything that we've missed that you think is important for listeners to know about what y'all do here?
You know, I would just encourage people to go to our website and look at how we've divided up the county into these 12 areas. And once you hear about, you know, an area plan that we're starting to work on in your area, get involved. I mean, even before we start an area plan, you can always send me an email, say, hey, I want to be on your mailing list. And we've got just an email list, running list we keep for all 12 areas. So the more people that get involved, the better it's going to be. There's a bumper sticker I love that I see every once in a while. It says, "The world is run by those who show up." So that's what we tell people. We need you to get involved and participate in this.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoyed it.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Chattanooga Civics. Our music was written and recorded by Kevin McLeod. If you have any questions or feedback, please send me an email at chattanoogacivics@gmail.com. You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at ChatCivics, or visit the website chattanoogacivics.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast. proud member of the Podnuga Network.